Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks for coming out. We're Tom and Trilby Becker, and we run Sunseed Farm, which is a four-season diversified vegetable farm just about 5 miles directly north of here at Joy and Maple Roads.
Our landlords are here.
Yeah, the folks that we rent our land from, that we lease our land from, are here tonight. Chip and Kathleen Letts.
They want to find out what we've been doing all these years on their property.
Yeah, so props to them. So just to give you a little background about where we're coming from, Trilby and I met in 2008. I was the production manager at the student organic farm up at Michigan State University, which was really one of the first four-season farms in Michigan, and was the first one to do a year-round CSA. We'll talk more about what CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture, means a little bit later. But I was able to, and they also host the Organic Farmer Training Program, which is one of the only in this region, like, intensive training programs for folks to learn, you know, the skills of how to actually grow diversified vegetables. You'd think that on such a big ag school like Michigan State, everybody would be learning how to farm, but a lot of their study is focused on, you know, the science of the soil, the science of the chemicals that they use and whatnot. Very little is actually learned about actual farming practices. So that's kind of where Student Organic Farm fits in. It was a great opportunity for me to kind of cut my teeth and get a chance to run a farm without any of the risk of running my own business, and having a lot of support from the staff there as well. Trilby was getting her master's degree in geography.
Well, I'll test my voice. I have laryngitis, disclaimer. But we met there. It was a wonderful time of our lives. Like, we met at a potluck, and the farming community is really rich and fun, and there's a lot of music and a lot of parties, and it was a wonderful scene and continues to be throughout Michigan. And so anyway, we were part of that and decided that we would just start our own operation in Ann Arbor and did that pretty quick.
Yeah, neither of us come from a farming family or anything like that. My dad was a mortgage broker, and I lived in the suburbs and didn't do anything like that except for planting petunias with my grandma in the yard when I was a kid.
I'm from New York City.
And so, you know, it was really, for me, just an adventure to begin with, you know, just an experiment. I'd try it out for a summer, and I found that it's a really fun thing to do, and you'll learn why. We decided in 2009 to come down here to Ann Arbor and start our farm. And it's this really wonderful day. We came down. I remember the first day we set foot on that property. It's a big 10-acre field with a huge, I don't know, how old is that tree, Chip and Kathleen? 250 years old or 200 years old or something like that?
I think the arborist we looked at is probably about
170 years old. So it's a very old tree, and it's been there for, you know, so many people have come through that space. So, we the first thing we did was we called up a group of volunteers, none of which I think we knew a few people that day. It was a group of volunteers from Selma Cafe, which was a local food breakfast that would happen here and raise funds for local farms. And we decided to build a hoop house. We got a loan from Selma to help finance that. And we had 30 or 40 volunteers come out from the community to help us build the hoop house, which was a great welcome to the community, since we didn't know anybody. Now we're actually growing on 4 different sites. So on sort of Sunseed proper is sort of the hub. And then we're leasing out 3 other properties that are within maybe a mile or mile and a half radius of where we are. So we're starting to grow a lot more food.
We have
fun.
7 hoop houses now.
Yeah, yep.
7 what?
Hoop houses. We'll talk about a little bit more about what a hoop house is in a minute. We decided to build our business around the CSA model. So this is a little picture of our farm. These are hoop houses in the background. So they're just basically unheated greenhouses, heated by the sun. And this is our crew and our dogs. This was taken a few years ago.
That's before we had anything at the farm, really.
Yeah, this is when the early days. Now there are hoop houses in the background. So you can see this is at our wedding in September of 2009, when we had everybody out and planted bulbs in the front.
It gets very muddy.
This was one of the more calamitous hoop house builds that we ever had.
It's in the fall.
Yeah. Wintertime, you can see it's get covered in completely in snow. So CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, which is the model that our business is built around, is really a partnership between people who eat food and people who grow food. It's kind of like a subscription to local vegetables in that you pay in advance for a season's worth of produce, and then we grow it for you, and you kind of just get what's fresh from the farm that season, that, you know, that week. So generally it's between 8 and 15 or so different kinds of vegetables in the share. And it's a really fun way to experience food. It's different than, well, I'm going to make broccoli today, so I'm going to go get some broccoli. Or I'm going to, this is what my recipe is, so I'm going to go get all the ingredients for my recipe. It's more of you're getting what's fresh from the farm, and you're kind of having to build your meals around that, which can be really difficult for people to wrap their heads around when they first begin that. But after they kind of get into the groove, it can be really transformational as far as just how they approach food in general.
Yeah, because we grow like over 60 kinds of vegetables. A lot of them people have never tried before.
Yeah.
And so even if you're confronted with a kohlrabi, it's like as big as your head, and you're like, oh my God, how do I eat this?
And a lot of people don't even know what a kohlrabi is.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that model, we have to actually be gentle with people and not overload them with kohlrabi and rutabagas and things that they might not have tried before, but it's a good opportunity for them to learn, you know, things that they like that they might not have tried before. But really, CSA is more than just, you know, this sort of exchange. It's more an ongoing relationship that we're forming with the folks that are with us. And it's a way for us to co-invest in the process of making food. So, you know, farming is a risky business. When we can have the investment of our members at the beginning of the season, that allows us to put that money into hiring good folks, buying the seeds and the materials and whatnot that we need, and to go through that whole process of planting and cultivating and irrigating and harvesting with the surety that all the food is already sold and we just have to deliver it and make sure that our members stay happy and they'll come back. So it's a lot of fun. And then in addition to that, you know, folks find that it can be really convenient. You know, they sometimes find that going to the grocery store, going to the market and whatnot can be a little crazy if they can just go to one spot, get these vegetables. Now we have three different spots throughout, you know, three different places that you can pick up on a weekly basis. So it's really convenient for folks. It's also just amazingly fresh compared to what you might find in the grocery store that's shipped in from elsewhere. When we're harvesting and you're getting it the same day from, you know, 5 miles away, you really notice a big quality difference. And there are a lot of varieties of vegetables that just aren't available at the stores because they're not bred for their durability. They're bred for flavor. The things that you can get into the store are bred for durability so that they can be harvested and shipped across the country and brought out in the grocery store shelves.
You want to talk about the vegetables and things that we have in the wintertime? Because we've got to make sure the winter.
Yeah, just real quick more about when we first started, just a little bit more on the CSA scene here in Ann Arbor. When we first started, we were the only ones around. There were two other sort of long-standing CSA farms in the area, Tantre and Community Farm. We were the first ones to introduce this year-round concept. And so, you know, we felt like we could really stand out, and you know, those people who like to eat fresh vegetables presumably also like to eat fresh vegetables during the winter time. And it turned out to be true. It's a good way for us to kind of distinguish ourselves in the marketplace. And since then, there have been so many new farms that have started here in Ann Arbor that we've still kind of remained the only year-round producer. There are other folks that produce during the winter time exclusively. Other folks that cut off their season when the winter comes. We've also introduced this concept for restaurants so that they can invest at the beginning of the season and get, you know, this really, really fresh product that they're not able to find elsewhere. So it's a really fun way to kind of partner with families and restaurants and other businesses to make the business run.
Especially nice for restaurants because they can tell us what they want and we can grow it for them like ahead of the season.
Yeah. So you can see this is This is the hoop house. It's probably evening time. Somebody's probably putting the hoop house to bed. So we, in these hoop houses, during, this is a midwinter picture. In the hoop houses, we can grow cold hardy greens and roots and herbs all the way clear through the winter. Even when it's getting down to 20 below at night, we can still grow these vegetables that can stand to freeze at night. So we'll pull these, and I'll talk a little bit more about how that works a little later. But we pull these big plastic covers. Sometimes we use a fabric that we pull over the beds. So these are wires that are just suspended maybe two or three feet above the surface of the soil. It's like an extra greenhouse within a greenhouse. So if the sun comes out, we have to open those covers really quick. Because underneath those covers, in a double greenhouse, it's going to be 95 degrees in no time. It's going to be super humid. And those plants aren't going to be able to cool themselves off because they can't transpirate because it's so humid. So we have to pull those covers off. We have to start venting the hoop house. It's probably 70, 80 degrees in this hoop house right now, even though it might be 0 degrees outside. It's a lot of fun. These are carrots and beets. There's probably another 20 different vegetables that we grow in the wintertime. And I just can't explain to you how wonderful it is when everything is frozen and dead and you can come into one of these hoop houses warm, everything is growing. Carrying out these big plumes of Swiss chard and whatnot. It's really good. It gives you that little shot of
And the vegetables taste so much better in the wintertime because they have to concentrate all the sugar inside their cells to keep from freezing, to keep their cells from bursting.
It acts like an antifreeze, so although they freeze solid, their cells don't actually rupture because they've concentrated so much sugar in their cells, which acts like an antifreeze.
That's why winter spinach is like candy. It's so good.
Yeah, we've had chefs begging us for sort of the leavings of our spinach, like the stems that we pluck off because they're just like candy, and they want to just like throw them in a pan for 5 seconds and serve them because they're just amazing.
It tastes better in the winter than the ones you grow in your own garden in the summer.
They taste different. Things that grow in the wintertime, they just get so sweet. The more freezing and thawing that happens to them, and so these vegetables are probably freezing every night, and every day that it's over maybe 25 degrees, or if it's sunny, they'll thaw out. And so every time that's happening, they're learning and learning and learning, and getting sweeter and sweeter and sweeter. And then if we have a warm spell, then that will kind of settle down a little bit. An interesting dynamic as well is that things don't grow in the wintertime per se. They just kind of hang out in stasis. There's not enough sunlight. There's enough sunlight to heat up the hoop house, but it's so low in the sky. The angle of the sun is so oblique that you're getting very little energy for the plant to actually utilize. So nothing's really growing. It might grow a little bit. But really, all the growth that's happening is before December. So, we plant for our winter stuff. We're planting in August, September, October. And then everything kind of just stops and just kind of hangs out. So the plants that in the summertime, if we plant radishes, might be 3-4 weeks before we're harvesting them. In the wintertime, it might be 3-4 months. So they're getting really sweet. But they're also developing other flavors as well during that time. And it presents a really unique challenge as far as how to manage that climate in there and how to protect them from the pathogens that want to eat them and the bugs that want to eat them during that time. So we've had a really interesting time building our business and financing the startup of our business. We've had great support from the community through, like I mentioned, Selma. There's a great program through NRCS, which allows you to get basically free money from the USDA to build a hoop house. We took advantage of that. We got a loan from the state of Michigan. We've worked with Greenstone. We have a great, unique partnership with Bush's, which is a local grocery store chain here in town, where they invested money in a hoop house of ours and a big walk-in cooler. And we're actually able to pay that loan back through vegetable sales. So when we sell vegetables to them, a portion of that goes to, we don't get a portion of that back that goes into the principal of what we owe them. So it's a great opportunity for us to have a good, solid client, as well as to have that that money to build our business and build that infrastructure. So it's been really fun learning how to do that and how to build that business.
Yeah. Well, it's good for them because then they've got a guaranteed supply of vegetables from that hoop.
Yeah, I think they found that, you know, more and more people are wanting to buy really fresh local products. And it's a good way for them to kind of stand out from the rest of the grocery stores, which might be a little cheaper.
Yeah, they came to us.
Yeah. So this is one of our CSA members at the CSA pickup. This is at our spot on Sunnyside Boulevard behind Eberwhite Elementary School. We're here we're there on Friday mornings between 7 and 10 a.m. And there's a lot of folks that like drop by before work. We also have a Thursday pickup in the evening at the farm, and we're on Tuesdays, we're at Wolverine State Brewing Company. It's a good time for folks to get their vegetables and some nachos and beer at the same time. So
this is our awesome crew.
Yeah, this is our crew from last season. Really good folks. One of the things that we've been really focused on since the beginning of our operation is the importance of creating real farm livelihoods in our community, to really invest in this local food, you know, this local food economy, which is the basis of our local economy in general. And a lot of farms are more dependent on sort of internship labor or low wage labor. What we've really worked is to always pay a living wage to our employees and work to provide opportunities for them both to learn and then move on to something else if they want to start their own farm, or to stick with us and sort of build a career at Sunseed. And we've just always been working to put positive pressure on farm worker salaries and wages in our area, which is only going to do good things for our food economy. So now we're growing.
I think it's an interesting thing to note that almost all of our crew members have college degrees, and they have a lot of opportunities. They could do many things with their lives, and they didn't study agriculture. Almost none of them studied agriculture. So I think it's interesting that they chose farming. I think it says something about where young people are looking for meaning in their lives and some kind of gratification and sense of belonging to their communities that's different than maybe what they had set out to do when they started college or what their parents perhaps hoped for them. Yeah. But you don't have to, you know, be miserably poor to be a farmer. I think that's an idea that people have about farming that's not really true. Tom teaches a lot of business management classes about how to make sure that your farm operation is successful.
Well, when we first started, we decided that we weren't going to be working 7 days a week, you know, 16 hours a day. You could if you wanted to, and, you know, you might make more money doing it, but it's not worth it for us to do that. We wanted to have days off sometimes, you know, or day a week off and be able to make a decent living. And we decided that we would pay people well, that we would grow the food the way that it was meant to be grown, and that we would have what we need. And if we couldn't do that, then it's not worth it, and we'll do something else. And we'll charge what we need to charge to make that work, and it has worked. Yeah, and you know, I think that in both working at the student organic farm, when we were getting all these undergraduate students from the university coming through and experiencing the farm, to my work at Sunseed, is that the work of farming can be really deeply gratifying. You know, for one thing, you can use all of yourself in the endeavor. You know, you get to be a botanist and a horticulturalist and an agronomist and all those things. But you can also be a tractor mechanic and electrician, and, you know, learn how to run the finances of the business and
build your own cooler
and do all this building work.
Pour cement floor.
You get to do everything, and it's so much fun. You get to learn what you're good at, what you're not good at. But you know, beyond that, for the folks that are working out there that are experiencing it maybe for the first time, it's you know, just being able to work physically and to be able to see the results of your actions really, really, you know, almost immediately. I remember the first time that I ever planted seeds, and the farmer that I was working with just said, all right, well, this is what you do. You know, here's your line, and just drop your seeds and then cover them with a little bit of soil. And it just seemed so like I was going to mess it up and they weren't going to come up, but sure enough, they did. And yeah, it's just, it's really gratifying when you can see that. And you know, when you work hard, more gets done. And I think a lot of livelihoods, it doesn't seem that way necessarily.
Yeah.
So I feel very fortunate to be in that position.
Yeah, I don't think many farmers have existential crises about what does my life mean? What am I doing? What is the meaning of my work?
So in those days when we first started, we were just growing on like 2.5 acres our first season. Now we're growing about 15 acres of produce this season across the 4 different sites. This is a field of potatoes, and my son Silas, when he was,
I don't know,
1 or 2 years old.
He's mine too.
Now he's 5 now, so. This was a good year for potatoes. 15 acres is a lot. It's kind of difficult to conceptualize. We have about 30,000 square feet, which is about 2/3 of an acre, under plastic, which are in our hoop houses. And each hoop house is, some of them are, they're all 30 feet wide. So this is probably a 25-foot wide room or something, so it's a little wider than this room. And some of them are 100 feet long, and some of them are 200 feet long. So we have 7 of them, and that's 2/3 of an acre. And then we're growing on about 15 acres outside. So that kind of gives you an idea of the scale that we're working on. You know, growing diversified vegetables is really kind of the art of maximizing your yields in a small area. And in the hoop house is kind of the finest, highest form of that art. just because it's such a valuable space. You know, you're spending all this money on building this big structure, and it's, you know, has the potential to, you can harvest, you can just keep on planting and planting and planting all year round. And so learning how to do that in a way that's returning more and more to the health of the soil each year, and at the same time, you know, bringing a lot of lovely food out of all times of the season for your members and your folks. It's a really fun endeavor to be involved in. So Trilby mentioned earlier, we grow about 50 different kinds of vegetables on our farm, and among those, there are hundreds of different individual varieties. So we grow, you know, probably 6 different kinds of beets and a dozen different kinds of tomatoes and 2 different kinds of celery. And, you know, there's all sorts of different variety that we're working with. That's a really interesting process of learning how to deal with all these different varieties and all these different crops and learning how to extend their productive season into the winter and through the winter. Here's a lovely squash flower. This is in the early days when we let our cats walk on our squash. We don't do that anymore. Here's some lovely lovely choy, and looks like some lovely brassica greens. So it's a whole different kind of climate that you're working with. And there's the same things that you're dealing with in a hoop house or in the field, but kind of in a really intense way. So this is a house full of tomatoes. We can start these in April, which is about a month and a half earlier than we could start them outside. And then, you know, there's a whole bunch more that we can grow in the hoop houses during the winter time. The challenge is, I mentioned earlier that process of trying to keep your vegetables for maybe 3-4 times longer than you might expect to keep them in the field and keep them healthy. So you're with those covers, you know, if we keep them on too late in the day, then things will start to bake and die. If on a cold day, if we don't vent them, then maybe there's too much moisture and they really need the airflow. Then again, if we keep the covers, if we open them too soon, then you know, we won't get that extra little bit of growth, or maybe there's less heat sort of built up in the system so that then that next cold night comes along and we lose more heat. It's kind of this bank of heat that you're keeping in the soil that you're, you know, bringing from and drawing, you know, and putting back in. And there's just really, really interesting dynamics. So for picture like a stalk of kale or a head of lettuce or like a, even just like a big blocky pak choy or even just a little baby salad green. If it's heating up really, really quickly, like if the sun comes up, it's a clear morning, it's 10 below the night before, everything is frozen inside the hoop houses completely. Everything above the surface of the soil is frozen. And then suddenly the sun comes up and it's 60 degrees underneath that cover within an hour. So what's happening is all those outer leaves of the plant are thawed out and they're ready to go. Like they're living their life, but their the stem is still frozen solid. So in times like that, we need, you know, so they're out there trying to, you know, grow and photosynthesize and whatnot, but they're not able to bring the nutrients that they need and the water that they need from their stem. So they're gonna die, they're gonna wilt, because they're just gonna run out of water. So at times like that, we're actually opening the covers early and letting them sort of warm up slowly over time. So there's all these dynamics that we're dealing with in the hoop house. That's why it's really hard to write a, you know, like an instruction manual for how to manage the climate in a winter hoop house. It's really a matter of just being out there as much as you can. And, you know, even now in May, I can be anywhere, and if it's a little bit cloudy and the sun breaks through the clouds, I have this immediate, like, deep stress response where I have to open hoop house covers. It's May. I haven't had to open hoop house covers in like a couple months. But it's still there because it's so important to be involved in managing that climate. Now there are ways to, part of that is just because we're really pushing the envelope as far as the diversity that we can grow in those hoops. And you can grow in a hoop house a lot more simply with a lot less time input if you kind of pare down your crop selection. So you could grow spinach and, you know, baby kale or something and kind of be your most hardy crops that you could grow and just kind of grow them in a hoop house, don't need to cover them, they'll just kind of persist. But we really try to bring, since we're dealing mostly with CSA and these restaurants that want a great diversity, we really want to bring as much as we can every week. Part of that is working with our storage crops as well. So these are the foods that people ate in Michigan long ago before they had refrigeration and hoop houses and things like that, where they're just dealing with root cellars. So we're growing maybe a dozen different crops that we can harvest in the fall and keep throughout the winter. So even now, we still have really great potatoes and carrots and beets, rutabagas. We do celeriacs and onions and winter squash and all these lovely vegetables that you can harvest in the fall and keep in a nice, you know, climate-controlled environment all the way through the winter. And they're great, even come spring.
Awesome.
So one thing that I was talking with you folks about earlier was just this dynamic of how to grow food and make it actually sustainable for oneself. And when we first started out, we had this dream of building our business on this 10-acre field, and that this would be enough, that we could meet our needs, that we could have a great crew that would be willing to stay out there and, you know, build success with us. And it became evident within the first few years that that was going to be a little problematic. When you're growing on a small scale like that, it doesn't make sense to invest in a lot of the infrastructure and mechanical tools that would make life easier. When you're working on that scale, most of it's probably going to be done by hand. So all of our cultivation was using stirrup hoes and little hand hoes and whatnot. All of our planting was done by hand. So every single of those hundreds of thousands of plants, you know, you're taking out of the tray and you're bending down like this and putting it in the soil. And that is fun and it's fine and it's good for you to a point. But after a certain point, you realize that your joint health is your youth and that it's deteriorating. So that was when we decided that, you know, not just for us over the long term, but in order to really keep good folks around, we needed to invest in some new equipment. And so we bought our own tractor instead of borrowing theirs. And we bought a transplanter so that we weren't having to bend over for every single plant. We could have somebody ride on the back of the tractor, and it would help them feed the plants into the ground. And with that came our ability to mechanically cultivate. So we have this great little sort of spidery little tractor that has these cultivators underneath the belly of it, and we have all these tools that we can put behind it so that we can actually pretty much kill all of our weeds, our non-crop competitors, as we like to call them, in our fields without ever having to bend over and rip something out of the ground. And we're actually able to do it in a way that's much more, much healthier for the soil by disturbing it less and breaking down the soil structure less.
Except in the hoops, right? We still do it the old-fashioned
way. In the hoop houses, we do most of it still by hand because it's just such a small space that we can't bring our big tractors in there. And really, it's all about just learning this sort of, you know, learning the best way to farm, understanding and developing this sympathy or empathy with these different plants, what they like, how to respond, how best to help them when they're under stress. And really, it's more as, you know, as we learn more, it's about understanding all the ecosystem dynamics that are happening on our farm, kind of all throughout all the different layers that we're dealing with. It's about the soil. It's about soil health, which is the sort of the foundation of the whole farm ecosystem and the greater ecosystem as well. And it turns out that when you have healthy soil, meaning it's well aerated, it's, you know, it can drain well, it has a lot of organic matter that can retain nutrients and retain water, and there are creatures that are crawling around and eating things and eating each other all throughout the soil, and you have the right minerals and you have the different, you know, all the different things that the plants need right there in place, turns out that those plants are healthier and they can better resist the things that don't, that things that want to eat them that aren't us. They can never resist us. But you know, like just for example, when you have a little plant, or say it's a broccoli plant, when something comes along and eats and takes a bite out of it, it's like, say it's never been bitten before. Something comes along and bites it, it goes through this whole, it starts this process of firing up this new chemical process in its body. And the more it gets bitten on, the more it does this. Where it's producing all these new chemicals in its body to repel that insect or that pathogen or whatever that wants to eat it. And those same chemicals that it's producing to repel that attacker are the same things that give it its really amazing flavor, and also are the same chemicals that help our bodies fight cancer and make us feel good. And it's these like really, really potent phytochemicals that are really toxic to the little flea beetles or whatever it might be that are so good for us. And it's something that we're missing out on a lot of when we're dealing with sort of chemically sheltered plants that are grown on a massive scale, versus things that are grown kind of more in a natural, closer to a natural ecosystem. And so it, really it's about developing that soil structure, that soil health over time, which kind of makes the vegetables better and makes our work easier as the years go on. The ways that we're doing that is, crop rotation, which is just kind of a simple concept of moving your plants, not planting the same thing in the same year, year after year after year. And imagine that some, you know, one kind of plant wants a certain sort of set of things from the soil, and if you keep planting it there, it's going to run out. Also, there might be a certain kind of bug that likes to eat that plant, and it's going to have a really, really easy time if you just keep planting it in the same spot. Just an example, there's these, if you've ever grown potatoes, then you know about the Colorado potato beetle. It's this little orange grub when it starts, and it turns into this yellow and orange beetle. And we often find ourselves out there squeezing and popping like thousands of these grubs. And you can get really good at, it's like shooting them, But you get orange hands, and it's nasty. But at the beginning of the season, they can't fly. They can only walk. And so I don't know. I don't even know how they do it. And you can grow potatoes out in the middle of nowhere, and they'll find you. But they have to walk there. So in the process, a lot of them get lost or get eaten or whatever. So it's a good idea to plant your potatoes as far away as you can from where you last planted potatoes. And sometimes you can plant things that mimic potatoes in the way. So we've planted like a trap crop is what they call them, like a group of eggplants or something that we start really early, kind of midway. So the whole herd, you know, invisible to us, you don't see them walking around or grubbing around or whatever they do, will all get hung up on these eggplants, and then you can come through and squish them if you want. So there's all these kinds of tricks with crop rotation that we use. But really an important...
You could make a dye.
What's that? You could make a dye. It's like henna or something like that. You know, and one of the most important tools that we use is cover cropping. So there are these other plant allies that we use that can help develop the health of our soil over the years. And this is a long process. It's kind of like composting, where you're taking your food waste or your yard waste or whatever and composting it. But we're just doing it over a really big scale, sort of diffuse. So we're growing a field of rye, or you know, maybe mixed with clover or hairy vetch or something like that, a couple of these different plant species that we like. And of course, the rye grows up, you know, this time of year it's maybe this tall, and in another few weeks it'll be this tall. And what it's doing is basically its whole body, for the most part, is made of atmospheric carbon. So it's taking carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and building its body out of it. And then we come along and we mow it, and it dies, and we till it in. And so all that carbon that we brought from the atmosphere is going to live in the soil now. It's going to get eaten by the microbes that live in the soil, and it's going to break it down eventually into stable humus, which is really, really important for our soil, in that it is able to grab and hang on to different nutrients in our soil. On a garden scale, you can use compost. When you're working with 15 acres, it becomes very expensive to buy that much compost to make an appreciable difference. So we can do that in place. We also have a great relationship with legumes. So like red clover and hairy vetch are two of our closest friends. They are able to take atmospheric nitrogen. So nitrogen is like the most in-demand substance in the soil usually when plants are growing. And when they don't have enough of it, they start to turn yellow, or they, you know, they just never really do their thing. Most plants have to get all that from the soil. They can't get any for themselves. So legumes have this bacteria that lives in their roots, and it's one of the only things that's able to take that atmospheric nitrogen and build its own body out of that. So then when it dies, it releases it all to the soil for our next round of plants to use. So if we really get on top of our game, and as we go, we're going to be able to reduce, or I mean, we already have reduced, but potentially eliminate our inputs of nitrogen from outside. So we're still using supplemental fertility. We use a mix of composted chicken manure and kelp meal and these different things that we're able to bring nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium into our soils to support our plants. We'll always need to bring in certain nutrients to certain mineral nutrients to help. So just related to this whole sort of ecological perspective that I'm talking about is the concept of organic. So we've chosen not to certify through USDA as organic. We do grow using organic practices, and we aim to surpass them, but we've chosen not to go through that certification process. And a lot of people assume because it's expensive, which it is, or because it's onerous, which it is, if you're not already keeping those kinds of records. But really, we found that we don't need to. We're working directly with families and directly with chefs who we have a relationship with. And that relationship has come to take the place of that federal certification. It enables us to have a we know we're able to really, or we really have to maintain a dialogue with the folks that we work with, so they can understand how their food is being grown. It's not relying on that label to mean ecologically sound or authentic or healthy for people, which doesn't necessarily mean.
Okay.
It's more developing that knowledge in our customer base so that they can make better choices as well. Yes. She asked if we have decided to go through any of the other private certification agencies. So there's our businesses. There's a lot of, you can get certified environmentally grown, or there's all these different other certifications that you can get that are not legally bound words like organic is. So in order to use organic, even the word organic in our marketing, we have to be certified. And if we use it and we're not certified, then I don't know, I guess we go to jail or something like that. But there's all these other certifications that are sort of parallel to the organic track. And we've chosen not to go down that road. We've chosen just to maintain that dialogue with folks. From just a philosophical perspective, I want to cultivate in my community a real interest and curiosity about the actual processes that are happening on farms. And I don't want, personally, to abdicate my ethical responsibility to label when I have the ability to find out for myself what's actually going on. And so I can choose to use my dollars in ways that reflect my ethical framework, if that makes sense. This is all related to sort of the greater dilemma that we're all faced with, which is the food security for our community and for our nation and whatnot. And the work that we're doing on our farm is like a really, really small little bit of investment in soil health and building topsoil and whatnot. But it's difficult to narrow your impact to these kinds of farms or these kinds of enterprises. Did you want to talk a little bit about sort of the greater picture that we're looking at?
I don't know if I can. Can people understand what I'm saying? Is it too? Okay. Well, I guess while we have the picture of flowers up, I'll just say a word about flowers. I think flowers are really part of the same, they are part of the same agricultural system that promotes the use of petrochemicals, like agrochemicals and toxins and fertilizers and human rights abuses and fossil fuel consumption and waste and everything that prevails in the growing of food all around the world to bring it to us. The same thing with flowers. And so by growing local flowers, I feel like I'm also part of this better world that we're trying to build that has local food at its heart. And so I grow for a CSA, and I grow for restaurants, and I grow for florists and floral designers. And so instead of buying their flowers on the world market and having them shipped from all over the world and arriving in boxes, and they're very sturdy but they don't have any scent, and maybe they're not the same varieties that they would be able to get here. A lot of these flowers, the fragile flowers, are the most beautiful, I think. So I grow them in a hoop house, or I grow them out in the field, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's for me to do. I enjoy it, and it's also just really nice to have the relationship with the floral designers and the florists and the CSA members, who just love having fresh flowers and the benefit that brings just emotionally and culturally. I think there's tremendous value in local flowers, and used to prevail in this country, and then the small flower farmers kind of went away as it became more easy for florists to buy on the international market, and maybe more reliability, or it was year round, or all the different reasons why people buy food on that way too, but anyway, so this has been a nice thing for me, but there's many more growers like me growing local flowers, and we're starting a cooperative, the Michigan Wholesale Flower Growers Cooperative, and we or I guess it's Michigan Flower Growers Cooperative. And so we're bringing all of our produce together, all of our products together in one place, so that florists and floral designers and anyone with a buyer's pass can come and pick from a really wide variety of flowers and get like a reliable supply and diversity. And so they can come to us first instead of going on that international market and buying things from all over the world first, and then maybe they supplement a little with local if they think about it. So this is trying to reverse that and provide really good quality flowers for local buyers, so they can come to rely and trust that product is going to be there for them. And so that's been a fun thing.
Just kind of about this, I've become aware of just, we're all used to being thrifty and smart when it comes to making food purchases, and we've just always done that. And like when I just remember going to market and having somebody dicker back and forth with me about the price of like a 50-cent, bit of cucumber. And then they're, and I'll take one of these $12 bouquets as well. and so, it's, people can, the CSA, the vegetable CSA, it's kind of like a greater lifestyle thing. And flowers oftentimes are a luxury, they're to make our house look beautiful or to give us a gift or something like that. And so it's easier to kind of just get what's pretty. But, you can also choose to make a wise decision when you buy your flowers and do something good while you're doing it, or make an investment in something that counts. And so, Trill has done this flower CSA, and so these folks that, might be buying flowers from elsewhere can get their flowers from Trill, and they'll stand for 2 weeks in the vase, and they're just, as long as you change the water every day, and they're gorgeous, and they're these varieties that you just can't get at florists. So just like the tomatoes, you can't get a heirloom tomato that's worth eating at the grocery store because they're heirloom tomatoes, because they've been bred to have like really thin skins and be super juicy and delicious. Those things don't go into a packing tomato. Same thing goes for flowers too. And you can start finding these kinds of local products that probably reflect what is important to you in all different kinds of products. So like, we have a friend who's growing a whole bunch of medicinal herbs, for those of you who are into herbal medicine. Anywhere, from that kind of thing to the grains that you eat to the meats and whatnot, you can get right here in our little local area. And you have choices as far as where you get that.
And just to wrap up, I think it's just, we're saying something about building a local food shed and the importance of having food. This is our daughter, Roxanne. She likes flowers too. Just building a local food shed. There's an interesting story about Cuba. They were the largest buyer in Latin America of agrochemicals, and they had, and fossil fuels were an essential part of the build of their agricultural system. And when the Iron Curtain fell, they didn't have their supply of oil and agrochemicals was cut off, because it was through the Soviet Union that they were getting that. They would give them rum and they would get all that other stuff in exchange. And so they had to go back in time to the agricultural practices of their grandparents.
I think the average Cuban lost like about 40 pounds.
Close to that. And so anyway, they started building diversified vegetable and animal farms in the immediate vicinity of their urban centers, so that they could bring the vegetables back and forth on horseback or walking or however it is that they had to. And they made dividers down roadways, and everyone's gardens were like reactivated. They pulled out all the flowers and put in vegetables and saved themselves. Now, to this day, the majority of their vegetables, fruits, and meats are raised in Cuba, and they still import most of their grain, because grain usually is on a large scale, and it's very inefficient to do it on the small scale like that. It's very difficult. But it's just a lesson that, we need to preserve our farmland close to our urban centers. God forbid something like that should happen to us, but it's very important that we don't develop it all or however it happens, you know, just let it go by the wayside so that we can reclaim it. And also people like us who want to have farms, we need a place to farm. We don't want to be farming way out in the middle of nowhere. We like living in Ann Arbor. We're attracted to urban centers. We like to go to the movies. We want to have a social life. You know, like young people want that. And also it's less difficult to bring food into an urban center if you're 5 miles out of town like we are, rather than 40 miles out of town or something. Yep. So it's important to preserve that. And Ann Arbor in this area is pretty conscious of that, which is great, but a lot of places aren't. And just finally about the loss of topsoil in this country, in the world, is very serious. By 2050, each person will have about a quarter of the available topsoil that a person in 1960 would have had to grow the food that person would need to survive. And so as our grain, and consumption increases, that our meat consumption increases most particularly because animals eat grain, the need for topsoil per person is increasing in order to feed that desire for meat. And so it's really important that we have agricultural practices that don't degrade topsoil, and that we're preserving that and building soil health, which is what Tom so beautifully described, like, you know, all of the things that we do to maintain that. And when you have this really heavy till, heavy input agricultural system that prevails, like in the world, and MSU was a huge part of that green revolution that was supposed to be the answer to this, to starvation, right? Creating lots and lots of food. In one way, it solved the problem, but only temporarily, because you need topsoil if you're going to feed people in the long term. So that's my little plug for the bigger picture about what it is that we're doing on a small scale here. It's something that we all need. And anyway, we have great parties at the farm. What was that picture before, Tom?
This was a picture of outstanding in the field,
which was
about 200 people sitting at one big long table, put on by Chef James Rigotto from Mabel Gray and the Root Restaurant out in Detroit. And it's this traveling show. They come around and do these big dinners at farms all around the country and now all over the world. We were honored to have them out there.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for being so attentive.